And tonight with Dr. Brooks Agnew, we're going to talk with him about a number of topics, of course, his hollow earth theories and weather wars. How about shadow governments? All that and much more next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. He's back with us, Dr. Brooks Agnew. Growing up in California around JPL and Caltech, he received his bachelor's degree in chemistry from the Tennessee Technological University. He had honors there. Favorite hobby, of course, is being the host of X Squared Radio. He explores mysteries of the universe. And, of course, he's an engineer. He is the CEO of a automobile manufacturing company in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's producing the nation's first affordable electric pickup truck. We'll talk about that, too. Lots to talk with you about, Dr. Brooks. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, George. It's great to be here.
You know, we got so many topics. I don't know which one to start with, but because the weather is so screwed up these days, let's talk about that. Give me your thoughts on this. You know, global warming, right? It's freezing. Cleveland, coldest since 1873. What's going on?
Yeah, I think they were going to have a global warming conference in Boston, but it was canceled due to bad weather. I'm amused by it. You know, I am a statistician, so I pay attention to a lot of the data that's being put out there and watching some of the manipulation and specifically how that data is being reported. Let's see, what did I hear recently? Oh, yeah, they were touting a document by the NOAA that says 2014 was the warmest year on record. Well, actually, I went and looked at the NOAA's paper, because I know they wouldn't just say that. They just put some kind of odds that it was the warmest and some kind of confidence interval with it, and they did. They said 2014, there was a 38% chance it was the warmest year on record. Well, I found that interesting because that actually means there's a 62% chance it was not the warmest year on record. So I decided to go through the data, the actual graphs, and put it into Excel and treat it myself. And it turns out that there was a peak somewhere around 2011, and since then, the Earth has been cooling. So, yeah, 2014 was the third warmest, but 2012 and 2011 and 2010, we were getting warmer. And one of the things that we notice, and you guys notice in the West, and they're certainly noticing in the Midwest and Upper East, is there's a hysteresis effect from weather. We call it snow. When it gets cold and it gets in the presence of a lot of moisture, you get a lot of snow.
That's right.
It's kind of a latent effect that comes maybe a season or two after the temperature change. So the best indicator of that is not the streets of Boston, it's the Arctic ice. So I went to the Arctic ice news outlet, and sure enough, it mirrored almost exactly what the NOAA was saying. In 2014, the January ice was the third warmest, in other words, the third less that they had in their records. And it got larger this year than last year and larger than the year before that. In fact, you'll recall when, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, when we were planning to go to the Arctic to look for further evidence
of the hollow earth
planets form, in 2007, a huge piece of Arctic ice broke off. We call it calving. And it was about the size of, I don't know, the state of Connecticut. Well, it opened the Northwest Passage to ships for the first time in, I don't know, maybe 100,000 years. So it was a rare opportunity to try and make this expedition happen. Of course, it's very expensive, and we had a great economy in 2008. So anyway, it didn't happen because we couldn't get the money together. The point is that we did have an indicator that the planet was warmer. Now, of course, we had certain factions around the planet that decided to seize on that.
They had their own agenda.
Yeah. Why is the planet getting? Well, it must be us. We're the ones doing it. And so this war on carbon began, and we're seeing the results of that in just about every regulation and tax and credit and everything that's out there. Some of it's beneficial and some of it isn't. Some of it makes sense, but a lot of it doesn't. And now the cat's out of the bag. All the data's been manipulated, the emails, that the integrity of the data, and there aren't that many climatologists on the planet, really. So, you know, we have the facts now. But what we do see is that we are having an effect on the weather with a process of, I'm going to call it geoformation. I don't really believe much in geoformation. I've not been a believer in much of anything. I got to have data. And I like data in the form of pictures, in the form of documents, films, things like that, where I can actually see things taking place. So in 1997, I was contacted by a group operating out of Washington State. They wanted to put together a video documentary on a system that was built by, in those days it was the Navy, called HARP. It was the High Frequency Active Auroral Research
Program. Was this part of Nick Begich's group?
Yeah, it was. Okay. Congresswoman Jean Manning and a couple of others had put it together. The producer called me. The director, Wendy Robbins, came down and spoke with me, and we ended up doing about 7 hours of filming because I asked some simple questions, because back in the early 80s, I had explored with radio tomography. It's when I was doing my undergraduate work. One of the things that put food on the table was working for the oil industry. And I explored for oil and gas and coal and around Kentucky and Tennessee. And the system I used only used about 50 watts. And I published a paper from an experience we had in Roseburg, Oregon. I believe it was maybe 1983 or 84, maybe 85. Anyway, the way the system works is we broadcast a fixed continuous wave into the ground. It bounces off all kinds of strata, gets distorted. We pick up that total signal, and we spectrographically analyze it and compare it to drill cuttings, and we can predict different layers in the ground and what's in between those layers. It was a very, very lengthy paper, but one of the phenomenon happened is we went up there, we sent the transmitter out on the mobile ATV. I radioed my operator and said, okay, turn the transmitter on. He turned the transmitter on, and about 3-4 seconds later, this earthquake just rolled my camper where all my gear was in. And he called back. He said, did you feel that? I said, yeah, I felt that. What was that? He said, I don't know. I turned the transmitter on, and it felt like a bunch of dynamite went off underneath me, and then it just rolled out in all the different directions. I wrote in my lab notebook, and I said in that paper, whether it was coincidence or not, when we turned that transmitter on, it felt like we triggered an earthquake. Well, that was why they contacted me. And then they started to explain to me what HARP does. And that's when it got kind of scary for me.
Well, let me tell you something too, Brooks. I mean, that has been something that they have been trying to publicly shut down because of funding, but they keep running it over and over again.
You know, that documentary was called Holes in Heaven. It's still out there selling. I go to conferences around the world, and I see that video for sale on the rack. It's everywhere. Lots and lots of people have been made aware of this facility, and there was pressure to defund it, especially after I went on History Channel. I built a cloud chamber so people could actually see what HARP can do to water molecules. I built a cold vapor cloud chamber. I created a cloud inside the chamber that was clear. We had the cameras on it. I flipped on the small version of HARP that I had in the unit, and within 5 seconds, all that water vapor went into gaseous state. It just went clear. And it was pretty dramatic. We repeated it on Conspiracy Theory. Actually, it was the debut episode of Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura. And then the Sci-Fi Channel had, I think, a guy, let's see, it was Joe Rogan Questions Everything.
Yeah.
And they asked me to build a large one. So I built a 64 cubic foot cloud chamber. It was kind of odd conditions because the room was about 85 degrees inside. You know how hard it is to make a cloud in a room?
It worked, though.
85 degrees. Well, anyway, it worked. We dissipated that cloud in about 6 seconds, and it was right there on camera. It was so dramatic, you could hardly get it on film. What happens is this frequency resonates with the water molecule, just like a microwave oven does, only at a much lower level. And what happens is the water will not coagulate into droplets and form rain. And you know, a harp is an ionospheric heater. It's used to push the ionosphere out into space. The ionosphere is kind of a soap bubble around the planet. It's very low density up there because it's high altitude. That's why it's called the ionosphere, because all kinds of ions and free radicals make up that band of molecules around the planet. It's where ozone sits, which is a triple oxygen molecule, very unstable, and it all reacts to ultraviolet and protects the surface of the planet from stray cosmic rays and things like that. Well, when they push it out into space, they kind of create a parabolic mirror off which they can bounce radio signals to submarines and different things like that. But they also create a void in the atmosphere, which the troposphere, the stratosphere, moves to fill in.
How many states might that affect at any given time?
Well, it's a good question. It's not that directable as far as the carrier frequency, because it's kind of a fixed phase array. There's one in Alaska, and there's one off the coast of just above Baja, California. When they work together, they can actually push a significant portion of the ionosphere out into space, and it could affect the entire western seaboard of the United States. And what I mean by that is once you push this out, you create a high-pressure ridge like a pylon, and when the jet stream hits it, it goes north around it, like up above Alaska, and then it has to come back down, and it comes right back down pretty much in the center of the United States and then continues around the planet. And when you look at the weather patterns, this thing they call the polar vortex, that's exactly what you see when those systems are operating.
Interesting, isn't it? Now, how many harps are out there? I know we've got one in Alaska. Any other places?
There are 15 active harps that we know of.
15?
Right. And you know, they're stationary facilities because they require a tremendous amount of power. You're talking a couple of billion watts of radio energy. And they're located usually near large open mineral deposits, because one of the other features of HARP is it can be used, the long wave that bounces off the ionosphere can be directed into the ground, same as my technology I developed in 1983, only with a lot more power. And you can kind of do what we call tomography. You can get a picture of what's inside the planet. That's, you know, oil's getting harder and harder to find, and you need these advanced instruments to be able to look over vast areas of the planet to be able to find these reservoirs. Once they're found, then you can go ahead and drill them and try to extract the oil from it. So these 15 units are located pretty much around the mineral-rich areas of the planet. But they do form a kind of global network, and if they were all operating at the same time, I think all of that energy poured into the ionosphere with no place to go creates a tremendous risk that I don't think anybody, before we made this video, no one was aware of it. And at least now, maybe they're becoming aware of it, and they're wondering how risky it is.
Can it be used for warfare?
Well, it can be, and it's so much so that in 1996, Secretary of State Cohen actually had to sign a treaty that we agreed with the other nations on the treaty not to use HARP as a weather weapon. Now, we wouldn't go through the effort to drop a treaty if it didn't have that capability. Now, the odd thing about this weapon is not only would it devastate a region if you could starve it of water or flood it of water, but it wouldn't have any fingerprints. You could just say, well, you know, God doesn't like you. You know, you need to get your act together and maybe it'll rain for you.
Brooks, so it's still operating, and the 15 of them are operating in total. When we look at what's happening, where droughts in California, though it poured yesterday, but it's still, you know, the worst drought in 1,200 years. Sao Paulo is, you know, they're in deep trouble. Why are some regions got so much water and other regions, they're in a drought?
It's because water moves around our planet. I mean, we see weather clouds, but water really moves around the planet in a thing we call the atmospheric river. We call it the AR. It moves literally billions of gallons of water around the Earth in the sky. In order to get it out of the river and onto the ground, we actually watch for temperature differentials. Now, it's seasonal, of course, warm air passing over cold air, and then the warm air begins to condense from the temperature lowering. It can't support as much moisture. It reaches the dew point, DEW, and the water begins to form into droplets. Sometimes we can see that with ice crystals and kind of get it started, and then it'll rain. But if those water molecules have been excited into the gaseous state with these radio waves, you cannot get them to condense. So that's why you have areas, if you're turning the HAARP on and you're operating it, you'll have areas that are starved of water for years.
Intentional or otherwise?
Well, I think that it was unintentional at first. Once they realized
what they could do,
they could
yeah.
direct the atmospheric river, they could change weather patterns. This is the strangest thing. It's sort of like when Truman got the communique that the atom bomb works. The first thing that he did is write an executive order to drop the bomb. And yet the scientist that built it had a little footnote at the bottom. By the way, we don't know if this is going to like light the whole atmosphere on fire, but they blew it up anyway. So it's just the nature of government, I think, when they get involved in things. If they can do something, they will do something. They never think about whether they should do something. So the evidence is piling up now that we can see from satellites, and almost anyone can get a picture of this now, the entire Pacific Ocean at times is completely covered in hash marks, both vertical and horizontal, of straight lines of vapor that are laid into the sky by airplanes on purpose. There, believe me, are no airways look like that.
What we call chemtrails.
Yes, yeah, chemtrails. They're not contrails. This doesn't go through the fuel system and then get burned in the engines and come out, you know, behind the motors. These are separate nozzles, and I did not believe it myself until I actually saw the nozzles for myself. Now, I didn't crawl inside the center tanks and see the actual pumping systems, but I read the testimony of several mechanics. I have seen video of these nozzles operating out the window, and I am now convinced that they are intentionally laying aluminum and barium trails into the sky. Now, we have heard members of the Pentagon, members of the political class, say that global warming is the existential threat of our day. It's more risky to humanity than ISIS ever will be. When the military thinks something is really a threat, they do something about it. With or without your permission. There is no transparency in this whatsoever.
Primarily without.
Yeah. Well, it's like they would look up and say, what vapor trails? I don't see any vapor trails. You see, there's no transparency. So if they're geoforming the planet, in other words, they're saying, gee, global warming's really bad. We need to block the sun's rays from reaching the oceans. So let's cover the Pacific Ocean with these hatch patterns. We'll turn HAARP on, create a high-pressure ridge, and excite all these ions, and we'll block all this radiation from reaching the ocean.
Couple more questions about this, Brooks, when we come back, then we'll get into the Hollow Earth on Coast to Coast AM. And you can watch our television program Beyond Belief anytime you want when you go to this website, beyondbelief.com. Lots of people are taking advantage of the free peek, so go ahead and do that in the company that works out the show with us, Guyam Television out of Boulder, Colorado, simply delighted with the way the show is growing and growing and growing. Just go to coasttocoastam.com. There's a link there, too, or you can go directly to beyondbelief.com. Welcome back with Dr. Brooks Agnew. Brooks, before we move on to Hollow Earth updates, so the aluminum and barium that they're putting in the atmosphere with chemtrails, does that somehow interact with HAARP when that's turned on?
Sure, it does. It acts as a lens. Once the frequencies poured into the ionosphere, now this is high above where the chemtrails are laid, then the frequency that they're bouncing off that ionosphere, either for communication or tomography or whatever, it resonates with those metal molecules that have been laid into the atmosphere. And so what happens is it creates a lens that lets the UV light through, but it blocks the longer wavelength, that's the infrared, which actually would reach the water and heat it up. Now, remember I told you about the hysteresis effect.
Yep.
Once you start cooling the surface of the ocean, it takes years for that effect to be seen in the areas that you're trying to affect, because the ocean is it's massive. It makes up the vast majority of the surface of the planet, and it takes a long time for that energy change to be seen in other areas. Well, now we're beginning to see that maybe we've let the freezer on a little bit too long, and we're going to have an overshoot. We're going to see perhaps more than a sixth, or I mean a six-tenths or seven-tenths of a degree C drop. We've seen, I think it's 0.64 degrees C drop in the last 3 years. That's pretty dramatic. But remember, this is a science that has data in search of a theory, not the other way around. We've already seen where data that disagrees with the theory of global warming has been thrown out or has been treated as an outlier. Or, as I told you, the NOAA reports that 2014 has a 38% chance of being the warmest year on record. You see, the statistics are there, but the general public doesn't get that report. What they get is a sanitized version that agrees with the theory at hand.
All right, Brooks, Hollow Earth. I remember back 10 years ago, you were talking about the Earth actually being made up of two planets. Where do we stand on all this?
My co-author and I wrote a series of books called The Ark of Millions of Years. Now, this is a nonfiction series. She approached me in 2001 with an idea that she had an idea how the Earth was made, and maybe even how the solar system was made. And she was an archaeologist, and I was at the time studying physics. So it fascinated me. And over a couple of years, we took some of the ancient manuscripts, the Zohar, the Sefer Yetzirah, the Kabbalah, the Popol Vuh. I think we used 44 different ancient books. We went through it, and I tried to explain the phenomenon that were happening in those books from a physics point of view. Wow, what a challenge it was. The first book was like 900 pages, so we sent it to the publisher, and they sent it back and said, no, this is way too big. You got to cut it down. So we reduced it to 560 pages. In that book was what appears to be data from ancient civilizations that describes something we called the union of the polarity. This is the combination of two planets that make up Earth. At that time, we said one is a higher energy and the other is a lower energy, similar to the human body. We have an animated being inside of the human physical body that we have, and then we have the lower energy part that seems to be getting older every day on the outside. Inside, we're a leaping gazelle, and outside, well, you and me. That theory built on over the next three books. It's about 1,100 pages, so there's four books in the series. And then we started getting some of the more modern data, and one of those theories that was out there was Hollow Earth. Well, the first time it was presented to me, I rejected it. I said, yeah, this is a bunch of superstition. I don't believe in this stuff. But I am really a hardcore scientist in the sense that I'm not looking for data to back my theory. I'll take all the data, and if it starts pointing in another direction, we'll form another hypothesis, and then we'll run enough experiments to where we can prove or disprove that hypothesis. And over the years, somewhere around 2005 or 2006, more sand got poured in that balance, enough for me to say, now wait a minute, maybe the current view we have of planetary core geology is not correct. It wasn't enough to say, well, the Earth is definitely hollow, but it was definitely enough to say, we don't live on a molten ball floating around in space on tectonic plates like in a bowl of milk. You know, the planet is much more dynamic than that. And the evidence was multidisciplinary. It came from space. It came from Earth observations. It came from other planetary observations. And it was compelling.
Because you're a person who looks at records and data, is there anything from the ancients that would back up a hollow Earth theory?
Wow, that's a great question. There is a lot, not only in text, like, for instance, the Egyptians wrote that there were Earth calamities and that the people actually had to escape into the Earth. That doesn't mean caves. That means into the Earth. We also have records in the Bible where evidently the lost tribes have gone into the earth, and in the last days they will return on a highway of ice out of the north. The Tibetan Buddhists had clear images of a hollow earth in all of their icons that make up their Buddhism. And at the time, Tibetan Buddhism in the 6th century was the primary Buddhism on the planet.
Right.
So there was a lot in the ancient records, even the Popol Vuh.
What about legends? Legends, not records, but just legends.
Well, I was going to say, in the Popol Vuh, they had the twin brothers that actually started life on Earth, and the records indicate that they came from inside the Earth, and the Mayans, Incans, Toltecs, Olmecs, all of the ancients worshipped the inner earth as a source of life force or life energy. And lots and lots and lots of the symbols that you see throughout South America, Machu Picchu, Teotihuacan, Chichen Itza, all of these things point to a life force coming out of the inside of the planet.
Are we ever going to get in there to find out?
Well, we're trying to do it with remote sensing, and there's been a lot of very compelling papers, Harvard, Washington University, there's been a joint one with Cambridge, and some of the stuff is really great. It's great spectrographic views of the inside of the planet, identifying the fact that we do have a solid single iron crystal in the center of the planet that might even have molten iron around the outside of it. This theory or the hypothesis was kind of debunked at first because they estimated, based on the data, that the temperature was 5,000 degrees C. That's a little bit cool by several hundred degrees, so it didn't wash. But another joint study done with what's called a diamond anvil, they were able to duplicate the pressures on the inside of the planet on a very small scale, and they ran the experiment and determined that the temperature was actually 6,000 degrees C, and that makes sense. That matched the spectrographic data, it matches the chemical physical properties of iron, and it makes sense. Now, why is that important? How does that point to a hollow earth? Well, it's important because now that we know what the core is made of, we also understand very clearly that the core is rotating at a different speed than the crust. It's rotating faster. And that supports the theory that Earth, the planet, was once much smaller, maybe as much as a third the diameter that it is right now. Same weight, just different diameter. And if it expands, it's got to leave voids behind. And, of course, as it expands, due to conservation of momentum, the crust will slow down. Since we have basically an iron-nickel planet, that counter rotation between, or actually differential between the rotation of the core and the crust, is what creates the magnetosphere around our planet. That's why some planets have a magnetosphere like Earth and some don't, like Mars, because they don't have a core that's rotating at a different speed than the crust.
Do you think Admiral Byrd indeed flew into the hollow Earth? through the North Pole?
I don't believe that. I'm not much of a believer when it comes to science. I really have to know. So when I reviewed everything that Bird had done, everything that he'd filmed, everything he actually said, what he did do in 1926 is he made an amazing, courageous flight over the North Pole.
I mean, something happened to him, Brooks, right? He didn't make the whole thing up, did he?
Well, let's see what data came from him and what came from artistic license with what he said. What he said was that he made this flight, which was incredible, at about 2,500 feet altitude, which is suicide, but he did it anyway, so he could see the ground. And he says that he flew over lush green areas, and there should not have been any there. Now, they didn't land. They went up, did their turn, kept pouring cans of fuel into the tanks, and flew all the way back. Then he did the same thing over the South Pole in 1929. He did a couple of TV interviews on it, wrote a couple of short statements about that, and from there, it kind of created this, I don't know, this kind of movement. Everybody capitalized on everything that he had done, that Edmund Halley, who lived in 1629 and drew pictures of a hollow earth, and then Marshall Gardner actually patented the idea of a hollow earth, and it just grew into this society. It started meshing with legends and some passion that is almost difficult to describe. But then there was this kind of diary that went out there. There were a couple of books that were written. One was called Edidorfa, which is Aphrodite spelled backwards, that describes the voyage or the trek of a man who walked into the inner earth from Mammoth Cave. Well, if you think about walking into the inner earth from Mammoth Cave, 900 miles straight down, it would have taken him about a year to get there, and he certainly didn't have enough water or food or light to last a year to reach there. So it was imaginary. And then a couple of the books, The Smoky God and some others, great stories, very passionate. I could
super
find no
stories.
Data to back it.
Animals, mastodons, everything.
Yes, there is a frozen mastodon that was found, and it didn't just freeze to death like an ordinary animal, you know, laying down, dying, and freezing. This animal froze mid-step with fresh honeysuckle still in its mouth, partially digested food still in its stomach. This is a you know, 8,000-pound animal. It doesn't just quick freeze like that. You have to have temperatures in, you know, sub-zero, 70, 75 degrees below zero to freeze something that large. The remarkable thing wasn't that one mastodon was found up there in the Siberian desert. The remarkable thing is that hundreds of thousands of them have been found in a ring in all directions, where they seem to be coming up out of a warm, lush area and then walking as far as they can go before they freeze to death and die.
Brooks, has anybody else tried? Well, of course, there was a fellow we had on years ago named Dallas Thompson, and nobody knows what the heck happened to him. He wanted to go into the center of the planet. Maybe he did. We lost touch. You know, he's gone.
But well, the best way I knew to do it was to put as many credible scientists together as possible. We had a crew of 100. Now, some was our people to try to manage the whole project and make sure that the integrity of the data stayed pure. But 100 people on one ship, a Russian icebreaker. We started with the Yamal, and then it was decommissioned, and we went to the 50 Years of Glory, and that was a great ship. The cost was about $3 million to get those 100 people on that boat, make a 15-day trek up there and back, and then, you know, go through the data, which probably would have taken a year or more. Water samples, samples off the bottom, air samples, magnetic samples. We were going to go through everything. Unfortunately, the window of ice was only open for about 3 years, and it just wasn't possible to raise that money.
Right, right.
So the only way to do it now would be with a drone. And I don't mean the kind of drone like, you know, you fly out there with a joystick you buy off Amazon. This will probably have to be a lighter than aircraft, because you're going to go probably 1,000 miles, and it would be extremely risky to put people on that drone. It would be pretty much a suicide mission.
What does it look like from space?
Wouldn't we like to know?
Yes.
I have, when we first started the project, I tried to get access to some polar photography. But the year after we started gathering data in 2006, the NOAA passed the Data Denial Act. And, wonderful agencies in their wisdom, they decided that public access to imagery, especially high-resolution imagery of the polar regions, would allow people to program cruise missiles. And so they blocked that data. They removed it all. You can't get to it anywhere. I went through 38,000 plus photos, and they were all covered in clouds.
Wow.
So we just have no pictures of the North Pole
Why
at
would they
that.
want to hide that, Brooks? I mean, what's the significance of not telling us if that's true?
Well, there's that reason, and then there's possibly another reason in that it's a disputed region of real estate. Several countries, because of mountain ridges that exist in them, Norway, Russia, Canada, all believe that that area belongs to them because it happens to be underwater, but it's a kind of attached to their continent. Why would they want access to it? Well, probably because there's the mother lode of oil under there. Who in the world would want to drill oil 4,400 meters deep water in some of the roughest, most inhospitable conditions on Earth? But, go figure. Anyway, I did not find any opposition to going up there officially from the governments. The Russian shipping company was way excited about doing it. I had several producers that were interested in doing it. But as you know, you're in the industry, producers often have to have benefactors to pay for the filming time and equipment and editing and post-production to get that kind of thing done. Then you got to go pitch it and try to get it sold to make your money back.
You mentioned Wendy Robbins. I worked with a young producer when I was in Detroit in my 20s named Wendy Robbins. I'm wondering if she was from Detroit. You got to find that out for me. I haven't.
Well, I think she was a little young for that. I think when I knew her, she was 30, and I was probably about the same age. So I think, if she was a young producer, she'd have been really young
Well, it
if
would have been 1974, and she would have been 24. So she'd be about 60 something now. Would that be her?
Nope, I don't
No
think
way.
so.
Okay.
Because the producer was maybe just slightly older than Wendy, and I just saw her a couple years ago, so I don't think it was her.
Well, with Dr. Brooks Agnew, when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast, we're going to talk about his quest to build an electric truck. He'll give us some updates on that. And then later on in the show, we'll talk about the shadow government, then followed with your own phone calls. Now, he's got a number of websites. We've got them linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com, and he's written several books as well. Extremely prolific individual. He's been a great guest of ours here on Coast to Coast AM, Dr. Brooks Agnew. And again, if you need to email me, that's George at coasttocoastam.com. And definitely follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just do all what you do by going to coasttocoastam.com.